the swamps, and I went on a to with Carson Scout, and he was exposed to that. I took a Kit Carson Scout and a Marine Sergeant to carry the radio, and one other Navy, my Navy staff, and we went to a very dense. Where the plane went in, there was just a very little of it exposed, and we literally.
Jerry, don't get away without talking to me.
Okay. We're back on. Very little of it was exposed, and we had to enter the by jumping in a lake, jumping off the skids of the helicopter into a lake, and then going back to the jungle to take a first hand. Of the feasibility of recovering the wreck and bodies. So I spent, of course, time in the talk. I also, you know, had to go to Saigon occasionally for staff conferences, and coordinating with the other U.S. military officials there. I also had the distinction of myself and my team briefing Admiral Colby, Ambassador Colby. And occasionally I'd get a call from Admiral Zumwalt to call up to Saigon, something like that. But so I had a fair amount of time in the field for actual field in combat, but I wasn't sustained. It wasn't every day, and I wasn't, my blood didn't call for me to be in there every day. And there were a couple of times, in fact, when we had a, I was assigned for a short time to support the U.S. 1st Infantry Division up on the Upper Saigon River, where we had started having a lot of Vietnam activity, and I had six boats up there. I occasionally went up to there, and it seemed like every time I went up there, they knew I was coming. Up around the Michelin Plantation area. So yes, I did spend some time getting my boots muddy.
What was your view of Admiral Zumwalt working with him? Apparently you had known him before. What was your view of him as an officer, as a commander, your working relationship with him?
I have to tell you that after 30 years in the Navy and having a lot of commanders that I saluted, no one has ever come close to being a supportive commander, Admiral Zumwalt. And with me on several occasions when there was significant military activity, to call him direct. And in terms that I understood, you know, don't worry about the chain of command, call me direct. And he was always supportive of me. Of course, he couldn't always give me the assets that I wanted. There were conditions that I was not cognizant of being down in the field. That, you know, for instance, I wanted to get napalm, and on the Navy aircraft that supported me every day, and that was not sellable to MACV, because the Air Force wanted to control the napalm. But, you know, I went up there one day with mud on my boots and had lost a few guys, and I said if I had napalm, this wouldn't have happened. And I was pretty vocal with some of the subordinates, and he called me and got me a cup of coffee, and he told me how the problems that he'd tried to do that before. And he was supportive. Come down and see us, go out and into the small areas of the villages and everything. He's the leader I've ever been associated with.
Mm-hmm. Because of his supportive nature?
Yeah. Well, he had combat in World War II, he had combat in Korea. He knew what the fellas in the field, how it was to support them, not to inundate them with a lot of report requirements for reports and paperwork, but to give them the bottom line things they needed. And before or after, never encountered a leader that I that he pulled, or you came close to pulling out of someone.
Was that a consensus among the men you served with as well?
Very much so, yeah, very much so.
But previously, when you had been with him on duty, what?
Well, on duty, you have to remember, I didn't work for him. I worked for a two-star admiral that was embarked on the ship. He was the commanding officer of the ship. The staff on the ship was under the orders of the admiral. We had a very good rapport. Outstanding ship handling. In fact, we went to a lot of ports in Northern Europe, to Copenhagen, Helsinki, Stockholm. An outstanding ship handler and high morale on his ship. So. When he was a commander, I think he's tops in leadership.
That's an interesting point you make about trying to get napalm on Navy aircraft. Admiral Zumwalt, when I talked to him, talked about coordinating problems with MACV, with the Army, and said that most of the time the problems were handled at a much lower level. He did not hear many of them, and when he did, he said he usually found that General Abrams was very cooperative in trying to help him because Abrams respected what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And that just strikes me as curious that napalm would have been a problem. Do you know what's behind that? Or?
Yes, I do. And you got to remember, for most of my years in Vietnam, or the Navy, had a two-star guy. Well, two stars in an army war. Mm-hmm. They're just division commanders. I mean, they were no higher than more senior than a division commander. How many divisions do we have? Mm-hmm. and how many corps commanders? I mean, and Admiral Zumwalt was the first Navy component commander to be three stars. His counterpart, USRV, Army Vietnam, was another four-star general. The general in charge of the 7th Air Force was four stars. And the Air Force fellow particularly was very, very sensitive of someone like, i.e. the Navy or Marine Corps, Army trying to take his mission, chip away at his mission. And the Marines screamed and hollered, especially the Marines back in Pearl Harbor when they put the Marine air assets under the Direct Air Control Center. To get air assets and, I mean, jets, fast movers, you had to send a message to the Direct Air Control Center for support. Like, day after tomorrow, we're going to have an operation. And they put what's known as a frag order out, assigning so many F-100s or whatever from whatever squadron, and probably Cameron Bay or somewhere, and they would be, you know, they were dispatched to go there. Mm-hmm. Now, certainly if you had unexpected attack of American units, all these other things, the air assets would be diverted on an ASAP basis to support you.
But you said that took about 45 minutes to get there.
Yeah, and that was reasonable. I mean, we know how far it is. We know what it is when airplanes are on a trip alert. They've got to get out there and taxi out. They've got to be cleared by the tower. They've got to get and fly down. Mm-hmm. I have no trouble at all with 45 minutes, but the 45 minute figure that we planned on, they always kept that figure. Sometimes earlier, but of course we had immediately Navy helicopters that if we came in contact with the Vietnamese, the Charlies, and they went into their bunkers. We couldn't destroy their bunkers with our assets, but we could maintain contact with them by our helicopters and also by our OV-10s, which didn't carry bombs either, weren't allowed to because they were an observation craft. If they had carried bombs, including napalm, they would have been put into the Direct Air Support Center system.
So this was a matter of rivalry then.
Yeah, well, it wasn't rivalry, it was organizational planning. And I can respect that right now.
I'm especially
Sir, go ahead.
Deepest apologies, but I got to get on another area.
Well, he was an air ops that fell in the field wouldn't be cognizant of, you know. Mm-hmm. And the lower your rank, the less familiarity you would have with how the picture was run in Saigon. But I had no problems with the way once I learned the rules, because I had the helicopters. They were there in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. While they were en route to wherever they were needed down here, my tactical operations center was calling the Black Ponies, the OV-10s out of Macau, and requesting them to come support us. So the helicopters finished their thing usually in about by the time getting there, and firing up all their rockets and ammo. By that time, the Black Ponies were there. They had rockets also. They finished their job. It worked out. It was about 45 minutes. By that time, the fast movers and the forward air control were there, 500 pounds. So that worked very well. And once I was briefed and understood how the system worked, it worked fine for me.
Mm-hmm. You didn't think that was a little inefficient, having to go through all that chain of coordination to bring in?
No, I thought it was a very sound approach. When you have these many assets, combat environment, you've got the clearance problems. I thought it was very well organized.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go there and you haven't been briefed, or you're not cognizant of some of the other things that are going on in the bigger picture, you know, it's easy to criticize and say, well, they should have gotten here soon. But I have, I think it was well organized, frankly.
Mm-hmm. So for routine day-to-day air, you had your gunships and you had the OV-10s,
yeah,
which had light weapons.
Yeah, right.
And if there was an emergency, you could divert tactical air in.
Yeah, request.
Requested.
Yeah, and they were quite good about that. And generally, the tactical air was only when we had these large multi-company sweeps that we ran into the Viet Cong in Bunker. They didn't want to stay and fight. The enemy order battle was primarily a sapper out. People had shot, put mines in, and shot rockets at you. And of course, it was always the local guerrillas we had to keep in mind. But usually the regional force defensive people kept them. Now, another important part of our operation that I don't want to miss is the EOD, the Explosive Ordnance Disposal. A small team, officer and two technicians, petty officers, and they were very valuable. They were on call all the time. And we also had the responsibility, EOD responsibility, to just up a couple of kilometers, the Shell Oil Terminal, where the tankers shuttled back and forth from Singapore. And so there were occasions when we went to their aid, and mines were in, always, when I was there anyway, U.S. Air Force duds that the Viet Cong had built with crude firing mechanisms for them, and swimmers had gone out to the water and put them alongside the tanker. We were not responsible for that security in that tank farm. The Army had that. That's where the Army's area was. But we did lend assistance, and on several occasions we disposed of the mines and get home and put them on the tank.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to mention about your experience or your work with the Admiral, your impressions of him?
Well, I think that, and my wife knows this, I thought it was a fantastic experience for me, a professional naval officer, to go in combat in command. And the Admiral asked me, and I have to check my wife. I readily agreed to extend for 3 months. I felt honored beyond my dreams that I would command a unit that was awarded the Presidential Unit Citation. Of course, Admiral Zumwalt had to approve that to move it up the line. supported 100% by the Admiral. And of course, I had other senior naval people that I had to loop, but I knew always that Admiral Zumwalt was my boss, and he was the guy that had hired me, and he was the guy that could fire me. But I had, of course, a captain over him, Antui, Commodore 116, game warden operation that I was reported for additional duty, but he understood my mission pretty well, left me alone, I suppose. In fact, did leave me alone. I also had a responsibility to the Army, too. Lieutenant General Julian Ewell, who was the two field force victor of the pacification reports and efforts we did now, including the training and those sort of things, they went into the big paper mill over there and got scores. And of course, our operations were really all under the, because we use RF troops, were really under the pacification umbrella. And, but I had very good relationships with had great support from Admiral Zumwalt's staff, which then Captain Tidd was the chief of staff. If I needed personnel requirements because of attrition or something, Constantina wire or anything like that, they were forthcoming and real quick.